morning, everyone. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording of episode number 76. Thanks for the audience for joining me in on this journey today. Today, my guest and guest speaker today is Carla El-Khoury. And for those who don't know Arabic, KH in Arabic spells the letter K, which is normal in other languages other than German, I'm assuming, and a few other languages, they have this particular syllable. However, welcome to the channel, Carla. I really appreciate you having us, you know, taking the time with me this morning and enlightening the audience on the topic that we're going to be talking about today, Arabic education in the Western region of the world. And for the audience, just a little bit about Carla. Carla is a lecturer, Arabic lecturer, and a coordinator of the Arabic program at the Department of Cultural Studies and Oriental Programs in the University of Oslo. And we had the opportunity to have Carla in Canada today, which is great. And she's visiting her family here and thought, why not? Let's have a podcast together. So thank you so much for joining us. As we say on this channel, Carla, tell us a little bit about yourself. On this channel, we say everybody's got a good story about how they got into this business that we are in, either language business or localization business, but everybody's got a good story. And I don't know, for just to warm it up for you, my story for localization, it was pretty intriguing. I'm a technologist by background. I was traveling back home from a business trip. The gentleman sits on the plane next to me and in the seat. He runs a translation company from New Brunswick. And 2 hours later, he ended up convincing me to go work for him in an industry I didn't know existed. Must be the gin on the plane that time. So I have no idea. So for you, the floor is yours. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your localization story, and welcome again to the channel.
Thank you so much, Robin. Hi, everyone. I'm very happy. Thank you so much for inviting me to this episode today of your podcast. I'm really very, very happy and excited at the same time. So I want to start by saying the most expensive thing in life is a missed opportunity. So my story started, of course, I'm from Lebanon originally. I was done from my bachelor. I did a bachelor in translation and then a master in teaching Arabic as a foreign language. And I was teaching at a local school, teaching Arabic for Arab students. And on a cold February day, I got an email and titled, "Do you want to teach in the United States?" When I read the email, it was a mix of emotions, honestly. I was scared. I was excited. I was happy. Should I take that? You know, moving sometimes from a very stable comfort zone and going to an unknown, it's a scary in itself. But I decided, you know what? Let's do it. So I read the email, and it was the director of the program, of the Arabic program at the University of Beirut, the American University of Beirut, the AUB, because I used to teach usually during summers to teach in that program. We used to have American students, and it was a great experience because AUB was known of their summer programs, having a lot of students coming from around the world to learn Arabic there and to get like this immersive experience in the Beiruti culture, from restaurants, from the Hamra streets, etc. So I decided, yeah, why not? Let's take that opportunity. I packed my stuff. I resigned from my job, from my life in Lebanon, and I decided to go to the U.S. I went to Williams College. I stayed there for 2 years. And as you know, the American academia is a bit overwhelming because there's a lot to know at the start. And so it helped me to develop my skills, my professional and my personal skills, especially when it comes to teaching and dealing with students hailing from American background. So it was a great opportunity. And then one of my friends told me, "Carla, hey, there's an opportunity. There's a vacancy. They want an Arabic lecturer at the University of Oslo in Norway." And I stopped for a second. Okay, Sweden was familiar a little bit for me, but Norway, no idea about that. But always in my life is what one thing always when I'm uncertain, when I'm in face of like difficulties, uncomfortable decisions, as always, I put a goal, objective, and I go for it. And this is what I did. And here I am 5 years later in Norway teaching Arabic there.
So, you know, what's intriguing about this, you know, we don't think of it enough, I guess, because there's you know, there's a 350 odd languages around the world. Mm-hmm. Arabic is one of them, but I would say it's one of the less in the localization industry, it's the less talked about language than in comparison to other languages. From a learning perspective and being in Norway, beside teaching Arabic to somebody who is immigrated to Norway and I want to maintain the culture, they want to teach their kids probably the fatherland kind of a language. Give us your take on, you know, your demographic of students. Are they, what background they come from? How do they absorb the language, the levels of languages, etc.? What's the tendencies there?
Yeah, so at the University of Oslo, let me give you a little bit an idea about the Arabic program there. So we do teach Arabic for 3 years. They start with us from scratch. We start by learning the alphabet and how to pronounce. So from scratch, we start with them. Arabic is part of the Middle Eastern bachelor. So students who want to start studying Middle Eastern studies, they need to take the Arabic program. When it comes to the population of my classroom, so I have students. As you said, we call them heritage students. They want to know about their culture, their parents' culture. They want to talk to their grandmother, grandfather with their Arabic. So they come to learn the language. We do have students who want to study Middle Eastern bachelor. They are mainly Norwegian. And we do have students coming from political science. And we do have as well native speakers. We do have some native speaker immigrants. They do come take the Arabic courses. Of course, it's the easy path for them. And you know, when they read on the website, Arabic language, it kind of sounds familiar for them. Okay, maybe it's a comfortable place to be there. So yeah, we do have a mix. And of course, I do have some students who are coming for different reasons, like love reasons. They got a boyfriend and they just want to communicate with them in Arabic language and they want to travel with them to their country.
And throughout your teaching Arabic, throughout your career in various countries now, what has been your observation in terms of the ease or the difficulties to learn the language?
Yeah. Well, as you know, when learning a language, there's different factors. There's the students themselves, there's the university you're teaching in, and there's the society you're teaching in. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the students, I'm going to compare a little bit from my experience because I taught in the US and Lebanon and in Norway. I can say that the American students, they are more motivated and they are more, we can say, they're not shy to show their knowledge. They go straight for it. They want to show me all the time. They know they're putting the effort, the dedication to learn the Arabic. When it comes to the Scandinavian culture, it's a bit different. It's like they know, but they don't like to show it. So you need to dig in to let them kind of show that they have learned something, that they can do something with the language. This was the first thing that I struggled with in Norway, I can say. Because in the US, when I'm in the classroom, and simply when you're teaching and asking a question, you see all the hands raised. Everybody wants to show they know the answer. When I went to Norway, I don't remember very well my first seminar. It just has explained for 10 minutes something. We worked on it. And when I asked the question, it was this awkward silence. And
I was like, quiet.
What's happening? It's like, okay, did I do something wrong? And here you start this self-doubt thing.
Sure.
Yeah. So it was like a bit hard to get that. Yes, they don't show it. You need kind of to push them, to motivate them, to show it in a different way. So this was my first thing that I had need as a teacher to work on in my teaching skills. The second thing is, I do believe the American in their system, university system, they are required to put the dedication and effort because their grade is divided into tasks, homework, project. It's intense, a lot to do. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the Scandinavian setting, is a bit more relaxed because the grade is only on the final exam. Your effort that you do throughout the semester, it is important to learn a language, but it's not rewarded in the same way.
So I would say, you would say also like, the different, I would assume, I don't know if it's a factor or not, but I would think that Scandinavian countries offer university degrees for free to their citizens. 100%. Meanwhile, in the US, it's quite expensive to go to university. You know, students comes out of universities in the US with $250,000, $300,000 loans that they have to pay. That's why they have to work harder to achieve their grades and make sure they take it seriously, because at the end of the day, if you're not taking it seriously, why are you going to university? Why are you paying for it? Am I 100% correct on that one? Or
yeah, you're 100% correct on that one. In Norway, they do have a lot of flexibility and chance to change major because it's not costing you so much. But in the US, you kind of focus on the one track and you want to be done with the lowest cost and as fast as you can.
Absolutely. Now, have you experienced somebody who never got in touch with the Arabic language before, not because of heritage, not because of anything else? They learned it, and you were able to converse with them in Arabic. Have you experienced that? Yes. Just like for me, I've seen it maybe once or twice, but it's not prevalent.
I do get where you're coming from. Well, it depends as well on the teaching approach you're using in your classroom. At the University of Oslo, we're using the communicative approach, which we do focus on what the students know about the language, but the main focus on what the students can do with the language, like not know about the language, but do. Means we learn it in the active way. I do have some students who started from scratch. They did not know anything about Arabic. And after 3 years, they are in, I don't know if you're familiar with the ACTFL criteria, which is they are in the B2 level, which means they can talk like a journalist in Arabic. They can report about things. They can have a full conversation in Arabic. But here I need to say, of course, it is self-dedication as well. It is a mix of a lot of factors, but as well, they have linguistic skills, high linguistic skills.
Yes.
But I did see it, and I'm seeing it more often right now because of the all the open resources they have as well, that they can support their independent learning of Arabic.
Carla, I heard a lot about, you know, in order for you to learn a new language, you have to immerse yourself in the culture beyond the classroom.
Yes.
Was that a factor in your teaching? And is it a factor now? How do students in Norway, you know, achieve that immersion in the culture? Like here in Canada, for instance, somebody wants to learn French, especially at high school, or they come from an English family, etc. First thing they do is they do a student exchange program, and the kids are, you know, hosted by a family in Quebec, for instance, that they don't speak English, and they keep them there for, you know, a couple of months, I don't know, a summer, or a few, whatever the period is. But there's that, you know, you have to really be in part of the culture in order for you to practice. As you said earlier, you know, people are shy and they're not 100% certain they're not going to use it. It doesn't matter the language, but you know, people are, if they're not 100% confident they're going to pronounce something right, they don't try it. And this is coming from somebody who never spoke English before, me, and never went to school to learn it, and picked it up from the, I don't know, the ethos, I guess, picked it up from the ecosystem that I live in. So I don't know. Immersion has a lot of factors in learning languages. Am I correct?
100%. We do give this opportunity for our students. I want to tell you something. When you're learning a new language, and especially Arabic, you're becoming a vulnerable person because you're becoming a beginner in life. You're just afraid to engage in certain conversation, to say, to pronounce something in the wrong way. Well, when students are learning the language, I'm not teaching them only to learn the language. I'm teaching them to be the learner as well. Because being a learner, it's just not observing the words and just sitting and opening a new window for them and telling them, look, this is the culture, this is the language. You need to go there. You need to put yourself. You need to expose. You need to be vulnerable. And making mistakes, I always tell them, is part of learning. So at our program, after spending 3 semesters at the university learning the language, they do travel abroad. They have 1 semester. It depends on the dialect they chose to learn, the Egyptian dialect or the Levantine dialect. They choose to travel to Jordan or to Egypt. They spend there around 3 months learning and intensive studying the language and getting to know the culture. We call it the pearl of our program.
Okay.
Because I do see my students before, after the study abroad semester. And it's unbelievable. It's a dramatic change. And their personalities.
So when they go on that program, the in-country program, if you want to call it that, is that something that they have to do on their own? Is it part of the program? Is it part of the, you know, the university program to send these individuals across? Is that how it works?
Yeah, it is part of our program. We do help the students. We organize everything. We have agreements with institutions in both countries. And we do help the students step by step from A to Z to settle and to go to these countries. And it is covered as well by the government of Norway. They do get money to do this kind of experience as well.
So what I noticed also, I want to talk about another topic with you, because I noticed something else in your bio about translation. Where does that come around? How does that come about?
So translation, if I want to mix it a little bit with education, when I'm teaching always in my classroom, I do believe I am preparing translators. I am preparing somebody who's going to be an international citizen. I want to go to the Arabic country, who want to try to work in a translation, literary translation, who want to work in the embassy, etc. So for me, coming from that background, it helps me a lot in my teaching techniques as well, because I'm preparing that one to have this confidence, to build this confidence to become a translator. Okay. But I want to say something as well, that I have a lot of students when they were done with their bachelor and their master's as well in Middle Eastern studies with Arabic studies, now they became translators of literary book from Arabic to Norwegian and Norwegian to Arabic. So they are key factors in letting Norwegian know more about short stories and the Arabic word.
Okay. But do you do translation yourself? Like, do you actually translate, or you don't translate, or you just teach, right?
I do a small project on the side, honestly. Yeah. Because teaching is most of my time.
Takes a lot of time.
Yes.
Okay, sticking to teaching then. So you've done teaching in Lebanon. You've done teaching in the US. You've done teaching in Norway. What's next for you?
It's a great question, honestly. What I know definitely in life is growing is about stretching your life and always trying to go in uncomfortable places. So when I talk about the future, definitely right now, I'm still seeing myself teaching in Norway, because there's a lot of projects we're trying now to implement there. But I don't know in the future if I'm going to go in another context, in another place. I'm definitely open for that, because I see my students, how they grow when they get new experiences, when they see the world in different perspective. And I feel for a teacher, it's the same way. It's about always, you know, rebuilding your personality and integrating new elements in it. So in the future, I see myself definitely in the field of teaching, but mixing more translation in it. I see myself going more into that field again. And yeah, this is what I can say for now.
And when you went to university, did you study languages? Is that what you did?
Yeah, I studied translation. I studied Spanish as an extra language beside the English and French. And and after that, I decided to go on the track of pedagogy. So I'm more specialized in the pedagogy and how to approach teaching, different methodology, e-learning tools, everything regarding technology and integrating it in the classroom.
So, you know, thanks for that. Appreciate it, Carla. Like, one of the things that we're, now that we got to know what you do a little bit and how you work with your students. So one of the things that world is dealing with right now, specifically localization industry or the translation industry in general, or if you want to call it the language industry, because everything revolves around languages, is that artificial intelligence. It's a huge topic. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's trying to address it from their own perspective. Everybody trying to figure out, where does it apply? How does it apply? What parts of it I use? What part of it I could use? And not necessarily deploying everything, but maybe bits and pieces of it. What is the thinking in Norway, specifically on the education side of things regarding AI? What's the general feeling about
it? Of course, when it comes to the university level and integrating AI tools, it's very controlled by the university, because there's a lot of concern regarding the student GDPR. So the university have a very clear policy regarding that. There are certain tools that are allowed to be used. ChatGPT UIO is specialized for our university, and Whisper, these only. Now, when it comes to the integration in Norway of AI, there's a huge funding coming in 2025 to build 3 to 5 centers, AI centers. These centers will be dedicated for research regarding usage of the AI in the context of Norwegian higher education and Norwegian education in general. So we are seeing a lot of funds from the government. When it comes to the university, we are creating locally some research groups and implementing projects to see what is the most effective way to implement those AI tools, whether in language classrooms, in content classroom, etc. So we did start a project last semester When it comes to Arabic, I have started a research project. We try to use ChatGPT UIO in our teaching and in the students' learning process to see the impact, how students will first like perceive the usage of AI. And now we have created a small research group at the Faculty of the Humanities where we focus on different languages and approaching AI. So it's a big debate. Definitely, it was a scary moment for the professors because, you know, a professor is considered like a reference of knowledge. So it was like a big concern what the students will do with this AI tools. What about their papers, reflections? So it was a big debate at our university. But now things are, do you know, are you familiar a little bit with the hype cycle?
Oh, I am, yeah.
Yeah, so I think we are now in the part where we, okay.
I think I have it on my wall here somewhere.
Yes, it is not perfect, but we're going to understand it more and take more informed decision in the future about it. So
yeah. That's right. So is there in the university where you work, is there like a specific degree designated to artificial intelligence? I haven't heard anybody talk about, you know, a educational degree, either on the computer science of things or technology or science in general, that is specifically geared toward AI. And it sounds like something that we're adding on to existing academic programs. Is that still the case? Or is there more leniency now toward focusing specific studies on AI specifically?
Yes, it's more studies focusing on AI. We do not offer yet a bachelor or any educational certificate about usage of AI. So we're still in the phase of discovery, I do believe there.
Yeah.
We're not yet confident enough to say that we can now teach it because, you know, to teach a concept, you need to internalize it and be able to do that. So no, we're not yet in that phase in Norway.
So Carla, what's your opinion on ChatGPT and AI in general when it comes to the Arabic language? One of the things that we talk about on the channel here is of course, AI is making progress and every day, and it's the velocity of the progress, the speed of the progress is exponential. It's pretty fast and everything is improving on a day-to-day basis. But we tend to be lagging is in the what we call the tail languages. And I don't know why Arabic is in the tail language. 500 million people around the world speaks it. You know, one of the world largest, you know, demographics in terms of language. But meanwhile, like, technology catch up to Arabic language, I think, at the end. That's my perception, at least. And it's not just my perception. But one of the main reasons they're saying, like I was talking to a few other people on the subject, and they're saying AI does not have enough data on the Arabic languages. And you mentioned like two of them, the Egyptian and the Levant. But if we have enough corpus, then we can probably train that. So have you played around with it on the Arabic language side of things? Or what do you feel?
We did a play around. We did a lot of tasks. We used ChatGPT as a generator of lexical and grammatical exercises to see if it will help the students to practice their skills. We use it as a conversational partner. We use it as a translator. So we tried to play with the students because I wanted to see how the students perceive it at the same time.
Yeah.
The thing is, you know, in Arabic, we have the problem of diglossia. So we have the MSA.
Problem of what? Sorry?
Diglossia.
Okay.
Okay, because we have the Fusha, which is the MSA, the Modern Standard Arabic, and we have the dialect. At our university, we teach them together. So I students in the beginner levels, they do write sentences, blending both of them. He could say, أريد تفاحة. Like he can blend with both because we do consider Arabic as one language. There's no firewall between the dialect. It's not the dialect for the street and the formal for the classroom. No, the dialect is the language of everything.
Okay.
So when my students were writing their sentences at ChatGPT, ChatGPT directly is rewriting the sentences in formal Arabic.
Yes.
So my students were like, my sentence, is it wrong? Should I not use the dialect? So it created a little bit of confusion, I felt.
Yeah.
And I felt ChatGPT is not yet ready. Even in the prompting, we work a lot on prompting, saying like, we're using both dialect and MSA, do not correct the dialect. And it was not able to do that. This was the first thing, honestly. Diglossia is the big thing in Arabic. So yes, we need a bigger corpus. So ChatGPT. And another thing, ChatGPT is not able to differentiate the level. So when you say, I'm a beginner in Arabic, ChatGPT does not get what is a beginner in Arabic because our language has a lot of words and synonyms. So if we say, عندي لدي, he doesn't understand this is for beginner, this is for advanced.
Yeah.
So I think to be successful in using AI, a criteria, we should have a criteria for levels, defining each level with a very common word used in that level. So that could help teachers and students.
And that's what I'm noticing too. Like if you, in general, like, you know, most translation in, we talked a little bit about how do we apply AI and what parts of AI needs to be applied and how much of it you apply. But if you look at the Arabic language, when it comes to artificial intelligence, it's pretty much human effort still when it comes to translation. That's the feedback that I'm receiving. Of course, AI used in here and there kind of thing for bits and pieces. But if you look, the comparison between how are we using AI for let's say Arabic versus how we're using AI for French or how we're using AI for Spanish or any other language combination, it's really a small, tiny fraction of where we're supposed to be. Like it's, to the large extent, it's still a human effort. Almost 100%.
Yes. The thing is, what I felt successful when it comes to education with the students is when you ask ChatGPT to produce a sentence in English and the students translate them into Arabic, that is where is, but ChatGPT and translating into Arabic itself,
yeah.
I do agree. Still a lot of effort. I think AI right now in the process of Arabic, you can use it as a tool to help you reach your end goal, but it's not, it will not give you the end product.
Mm-hmm.
It's not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt as a teacher, I can say as a teacher of Arabic, ChatGPT helps me a lot in preparing my lessons, in preparing my exams. I do believe, yes, it is a very good teaching assistant for me.
Okay. And for a student, though, it must be a great tool to learn. I mean, even if they don't do like, you know, you ask Gen AI to write their thesis, probably like for me, I use it for learning things. Like, you know, if I want to learn how to code or if I want to learn a new trick with my Microsoft suite of things, like write a macro for Excel, for instance, you know, it helps me speed up the learning process. Are you seeing that in the academia part of your world?
Of course, I see it when they ask ChatGPT very straightforward, simple questions, like explain to me this grammatical concept. What does this word mean? Like for very small, simple question, yes. And it helps the students when they are engaging with a new knowledge at home. It helps them to kind of make them understand the concept faster. But sometimes it's confusing for beginners because the beginners, they don't have the critical thinking to know if ChatGPT is explaining in an extensive way or this is what they just need to know for right now at that level. So I do feel after I use it with the beginner, it would be a perfect tool for the advanced learner of Arabic more than the beginner one.
Going back to the Arabic language, Carla, for the audience who don't know a lot of about Arabic other than what we hear on the news, would you mind sharing with our audience how many Arabic dialects are out there? And without naming them, if you can name a few if you want to, however you prefer. So.
Yeah. So there's a big variety of dialect in the Arab world, but mainly, we do teach the Levantine one. The Levantine, we're talking about the dialect of Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, and Lebanon and Syria.
Okay.
So this one, we do teach it at the University of Oslo, and we do teach the Egyptian one. And why the Egyptian one? Because it's considered very easy to be understood by all the Arab because of the movies and of the songs. So we grew up knowing that dialect. So if you talk mm-hmm. Egyptian in any Arab country, they will understand.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we go to the Darija, which is the dialect of Morocco, it's called Darija, it's going to get a little bit faster and a little bit, we call it, like it has a lot of French taste flavor in it. When you go to the Gulf dialect, it's a bit more thicker and it's harder to understand. It's, I can say, like the Iraqi one as well. But mainly always when we talk about teaching Arabic, we go directly to Levantine or Egyptian. But now we're seeing a big booming in the Moroccan dialect and in the Tunisian one. Okay. So we're seeing the emergence of a new language schools there.
So the Moroccan and the Tunisian, it's quite interesting, I believe, in terms of the, you alluded to earlier, the French implication or the French influence in the language. So does that mean, are we seeing French words inside of the language now? Like, you know, I would say, as far as I remember, I guess, I don't know if I remember correctly, back in the days when I was young and I was living in Beirut, as the town that you come from, I used to hear people speaking like, words in French, words in Arabic, and they mix them together. Is that the idea in Tunisia and Morocco?
Yes, it is. It is very common to see a Tunisian mixing a lot of French word, and you can see it as well in the pace when they're speaking. It's a very French, like it's very fast, like the French language. So that's very obvious in the words and the pace of speaking.
And what about the Spanish influence on those two languages? I thought there would be Spanish influence, no?
No Spanish word in itself, but we have a lot of Arabic words. From Spanish, but we're still using them. And Spanish uses a lot of Arabic words at the same time. So we do have this exchange in words, but we do not use like literally Spanish word when speaking in a normal conversation.
Okay. Yeah. No, because I thought there would be some influence, like especially in the Tuareg region around Spanish influence in those languages. I thought the Tuareg language has a, because I know a couple of people here, they used to go to university. They became a friend of mine. And, you know, they told me that, you know, as they speak it, I can hear these, you know, I hear them speak and I can hear the Spanish words inside of the language.
Okay. Okay. I mean, for me, it's, I never like talk to a Tunisian or to a Moroccan where I heard a little bit of Spanish influence. Yeah. I see more the French one, but definitely there's some of exchange of words in those languages.
And I believe that, you know, Arabic, it's not the only language that has these embedded other languages inside of their everyday use of the language. You'd hear it also in Latin America. You hear it also in Canada. I mean, English and French spoken together interchangeably sometime. We have a region on the eastern side of Canada. It's famous for switching between English and French and putting the sentences in a way that first time I heard it, I learned French when I was a young kid. So the first time I heard it, I found it very strange. And, you know, j'ai pitié mon teint dans la backyard, for instance. Now my audience going to flip out when I say that. But this is, you know, it's a similar idea, but all languages have that. All other cultures have that. Filipinos have it. Many other languages have like other languages embedded in their day-to-day activity of how they use the language. It's not unusual. 100%.
Yes, 100%.
And do, as academia, like, do you try to purify that? Are you okay with using it the way it is? How do you do that?
Of course. And we have, like, we do call sometimes something called code switching, which is, yes, we do encourage, because at the end of the day, you want to teach your students the reality of a language. You don't want to teach them a perfect language. When they go to the street and when they speak it with people and get exposed to the reality of the language, they feel they are different or odd. You want to just teach them the language as it is, with all its imperfection, as we call it, despite I don't call it this way, but yeah.
Carla, when we teach a language, when we talk about languages, we can't talk about it without talking about the culture where the language came from, because we are the product of our own environment. Mm-hmm. So when you're teaching Arabic, what is your sense of the Arabic culture being understood or misunderstood? And is there a clarity in there, or people still have that misunderstanding, I would say, or understanding? I don't know where they sit on the fence there.
That's a very, very honestly good question. I mean, as you say, culture and language, they come hand in hand. So we do focus a lot on developing the cultural and what we call it the intercultural competence, which is like the students are more aware about their culture and how they compare it to the new culture they are learning. Of course, a lot of students, they come with the influence of the media, they come from the influence of their parents, of everything they heard about the Arab countries and the Arab culture throughout their life. And you can see how the shift happened. It doesn't happen from the first semester.
Yes.
It happened when they do experience things and study abroad semester, when they travel and they experience how the Arab live, when we talk about hospitality, when we talk about like how people are friendly and you can have a conversation with somebody you don't know. When you talk about it in the classroom, it's weird. But when you go and you live in a society and someone approach you to show you something, you feel grateful. So you do understand things. They don't come naturally. They take time and they take a lot of awareness. But they do happen, and they change a lot in my students' personality as well. I mean, I do have a lot of students coming back from study abroad semester, and they just comment, oh my God, Oslo is so boring. Oh my God, the weather is so cold. We need the Arab food, Middle Eastern food. And I'm like, what? They understand me more now.
Yeah. You know, it sounds to me like when they stop listening to the culture through the eyes of the media or through the eyes of television or whatever the content that they're consuming about this particular culture, I think they get a different perspective. I think when you drop a fabricated message and go find yourself a better message that suits you, I think this is when you get the reality check.
Yes. And it's the reality that you have created from your own experience. And this is a solid reality, because it's not a reality built from something you have heard about, but you have something you live.
Correct.
And you experience. That's the difference.
Have you looked into the Canadian Arabic teaching subject in Canada? And what was your impression? What did you find out? Is there a program? I don't know if there is one or not. I have no idea. I'm assuming there are small schools, but I didn't know if they have them like at a university degree level.
Yeah, I did. I did say that Arabic is mainly in Canada part of Islamic studies. So I saw at the University of Toronto, they have it. They do have a center for continuous education where they offer summer and Arabic courses there. But mainly in Canada, it is related to Islamic studies department.
Okay.
The Arabic language. I did have connection with some teacher at the University of McGill
in Montreal. Yeah.
Yes, and I did have some contact with the University of Toronto and as well with the University of Victoria. And we're trying to see if we can do some collaboration together. I do still feel that Arabic here is taught a little bit in a traditional way. The main focus is on translation and on grammar, while we have shifted in Europe more into communicative approach.
That's right.
So, but both of them, the translation methods and the communicative approach, I think they're complementary in a way.
That's right.
They are not the opposite.
And you know, I'm glad you mentioned that's the reason why I asked you about the language programs in Canada for when it comes to Arabic. If you, and I know, you know, you're already engaged with the job that you have. But if you're ever thinking about opening the channels here in Canada, I know a few people in the at the academia level that just let me know. And I'm saying to you, and I say to all my audience, I help anybody. But if you want me to connect you with somebody in McGill or whatever other universities, just let me know, at least just to have a conversation and have an exploratory discussion, see where this goes. So it's academia, so it's a broad topic, and languages is also equally broad topic, because there's many languages out there and there's various ways you can teach those languages, especially now when we introduce Academia Plus technology to it. It's taken a different perspective altogether, or context altogether. So what is the plan for you going forward? Are you staying in Oslo, or what are you doing?
That's a big question. So my husband is Canadian, so he's still figuring out if he's going to move there or I'm going to be moving here, but plans are not clear yet. But as I said before, I'm following any opportunity of growth in my life. I know that anything's going to happen in the future, I'm ready for it. I'm ready to broaden my perspective and experiences. And I want to say something about experiences here. We're launching next semester at the University of Oslo, a very fun project, which is creating an online blog where students write about their experiences learning the Arabic language and culture. Because we have figured out, if as an Arab, I want to talk to Westerns about my culture, they're going to say, okay, she's Arab, she's from Lebanon. But what about now discovering the culture through the eyes of a Western student? How they're going to present the culture for them? So we're working on this project.
Instead of, I love the idea, instead of, you know, you know, once somebody from the culture describing it from their own point of views, you know, and you can see, like, I can see the benefit with this, because there's got to be some transformation in there for somebody who has a specific opinion, and that opinion either augmented or changed altogether after they get exposed to the culture. That's powerful in my
100%. And the student, they have really very powerful insights and some comparison that I never thought about. So I feel like, always bridging those and building those bridges of knowledge between people who are interested in learning the language and skeptical a little bit, and those who learn it. It's very crucial.
Yeah. Of course, I do have some contacts also in Oslo. I'll connect you with a few people in Norway if you want, just trying to help. Before I wrap up the conversation, Carla, once again, so grateful that you spent some time with me this morning recording this podcast. I'm glad that you're here in Canada. We didn't have to do this across the ocean. And I wish you all the best, but last comments for you.
Thank you so much, Robin. I think those conversations are needed. You know, I think a lot of teachers now, they're gonna maybe listen to this podcast, and a lot of students and a lot of people who are interested maybe in digging and starting learning Arabic. I want to tell you thank you, Robin, for bringing up and talking about all these important questions. And I feel, I don't know, it was nice connecting as well with you, connecting with somebody maybe coming from my same background in Canada. And I'm very grateful that you reached out, Robin. It's a pleasure.
Pleasure meeting you as well. And
yeah, it's such an interesting person and such an interesting podcast. And I'm really happy. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thanks to you, Carla. And thanks for the audience this morning for joining me on this recording of the podcast, episode number 76. I appreciate you listening in. If you're coming in on our podcast, which is available on all channels, Spotify, Applecast, you name it. And also, I appreciate you viewing this YouTube video as well. We're going to put a YouTube video up of the particular conversation that we have here, as we usually do in all of our episodes. And for our audience, also, if you don't mind liking and sharing the content, I really appreciate it. It helps the channel a little bit. And reminder that our channel is the fastest growing channel in the localization industry. So I'm happy and thankful and grateful to everybody who's engaging with our content. Also, remember to check out the blog post, which I write every episode, where we summarize the conversation in a blog post, and I'll put it on my blog post site, robinayoub.blog. Feel free to check out the previous episodes and summary of previous episodes, summary of previous conversations, and look forward to your comments, your feedback. And if you have any ideas about a particular subject that you'd like me to talk about with one of our experts panels that we normally host on this podcast, please send them my way. And happy to make the contact with the appropriate expert and bring them on board and have that conversation. To everybody, please stay safe, and we'll talk to you at the next episode. Thank you, Carla, for joining me. Appreciate it. Thank you again for everybody.
Thank you so much.